My name's Joe Ravitt. I work at the University of Manchester. I run the Centre for Urban and Regional Ecology. And I've worked on sustainable cities for about 20 years. And before that, I was a community architect and planner. The reason I'm here is that public health is one of the big challenges of today. And it's likely to get more challenging in the years to come. On many grounds, cost, technology, expectations, lifestyles, and so on. So we need new ways of thinking to deal with these new challenges. We've been working for a decade or so on new ways of thinking in relation to different areas, urban planning, environment and climate policy, technology and innovation policy, etc., etc. We think these ways of thinking have quite a lot to offer the public health debate. If we look more broadly, we can see it's not only about health, it's about well-being. And if we look at well-being, it's not only that, it's about communities, how are they working and functioning, and about the people in them. Are they achieving their aspirations? Are they living in a state of security? And so on. So we have to think big, we have to think detailed, all at the same time. It's a new kind of thinking process. So the lecture tonight is really to explore some of the first steps in this thinking process. We don't have all the answers. It's not a blueprint. It's not a policy document. It's rather more like thinking in progress, which people in many walks of life seem to find quite useful. So here we are. Well, thank you very much. Great to be here. You'll probably notice quite quickly I'm not a Scotsman. Sorry about that. I am from the north of England, so maybe that's like halfway there or here. Tonight I'd like to talk about something which doesn't have complexity in the title. And to be honest, I'm totally amazed that you've all come here to hear a lecture which had complexity in the title, because if we did this in England, nobody would come, you know, which is why I'm really keen on Scotland as a beacon of intellectual endeavour and enlightenment and so on, because in England, you know, things are sort of really, you know, down in the dumps. And the health service is one of those things which is even downer in the dumps than most. So I'll come back to that. Also, I think each of you will have a handout. You're not expected to read it word by word. In fact, there's quite a few typos, but you will be tested at the end. And the handout is really to sort of summarise my own thinking as much as anything else on this huge and important set of issues. And in particular, to set out, for my own satisfaction as much as anything else, the application of the methods and the tools that we've been developing in Manchester for some time now. For myself, I was an architect and planner. Let me just call up the background bit. I did a big book called The City Region 2020. This was billed at the time the world's largest feasibility study. It looked at Greater Manchester in every which way, and looked at systematically at all the linkages between planning and health and transport and employment and land use and climate change and so on and so on. To be honest, it was of its time. It was published in 2000. We've learnt quite a bit in the medium in the last decade. So really what I'm trying to share with you this evening is to say, yeah, you know, these are the things that we have been learning, which will be taking shape in the book on the right, the 3.0 book, in my mind. Now, 3.0 is just a sort of handy sort of label. I'll come on to what the 3.0 refers to in a moment. Firstly, just back to the contents. Well, the contents are arranged in the way that the method works, and the reason we use a method of thinking is because we're trying to think about quite large and complex things. It's like we can see, yeah, public health, healthy cities, new healthcare systems fit for the 21st century. It's huge, it's complex, it's almost overwhelming if you're trying to understand the whole thing at once. So we need some way of drawing a map and then finding out the best routes across the landscape of that map, and so on. So this is why this evening and in many other presentations and workshops that I've been doing, we use this kind of four-step method as one way to explore this landscape and draw these maps, and then say, well, we can draw a map of the landscape at the beginning, then we think and create and so on, and then we come back at the end, we draw a landscape of we draw a map of the road, a road map, so-called. So, in this short journey, I'll use a lot of pictures. That's my little hobby. There is a website somewhere on the handout. All in progress, nothing finished, and so on. We use a process of deliberation and dialogue. Now, if I had the choice, I would not be standing here and everybody in rows over there. I would be, you know, we'd actually rearrange the room into a circle. Well, it's not quite the right shape, to be honest, and so on. But the whole basis of thinking about complex and challenging situations is, well, we have to find new ways to think. So the process of doing that is also very important. To help that along, we developed a technology. And I'll just briefly flick over to the technology. It's called the Synergy Forum. You can download various instructions and so on. I've set up a table called Well Health 3.0. There's nothing on it as yet, but we'll come back to that. And just for illustration, there are other forums which look at, well, security. For instance, this was the most recent foresight project that I was doing, and actually I'm not an expert on security, but you can see just very roughly that different people around the table can make comments, and if they agree it looks green, and if they disagree it looks red, and then you can analyse the whole structure of a discussion about some complex problem or some unknown future or some really difficult to handle roadmap and so on. And you can build in pictures and YouTube clips and whatever and so on. Now, I won't talk about that too much, but if it works out, we'll come back to that and generate a little bit of discussion, which would be probably preferable to me just talking and talking. Also, on that note, if you see me swigging from a small bottle, it's not whiskey, it's cough medicine, because I was playing in the snow the other day and I came back with a sore throat and so on, you know, as you do. So that's the technologies, and the questions, they're actually printed on the handout for easy reference, but we'll come up to them in 10 or 15 minutes' time. The other question that I wanted to ask is, who is here? I guessed at the from the list that we have a pretty good spread. Not everybody is medical or healthcare, but could I just kind of ask for a kind of very quick poll? How many people here are directly working on public health? Okay, and how many people are representing users and clients or patients? We used to call them, and so on. That's great. And doctors, we have doctors here. Excellent. And nurses or other auxiliaries, right? NHS managers. Okay. And other public sector people. There might be housing, education, whatever. And private sector people. Excellent. NGOs. Okay. Quite a few NGOs. Research, universities, etc. Freelancers. And there's another category. Which, well, you can use your imagination. Is anyone in the other category? That's interesting. Okay. Well, there isn't time for everybody to sort of, you know, introduce themselves, unfortunately, unless, I think, is there a drink thing afterwards? Well, that's an ideal opportunity. So, well, what do we have? Well, just to introduce some of the pictures... these are the characters who've sort of moved into my book project. And They are little people who sort of follow me around. Actually, they even wake me up in the middle of the night thinking, hey, have you thought of this? And I don't agree with that, and so on. So, well, there they are. I could tell their life stories and so on, but maybe another time. But their role is really to sort of say, well, wait a minute, you're coming up with all these, you know, complicated flowcharts and things. You know, what's it really mean in human terms? So they spread into various kind of cartoonish adventures and so on. One of which is to say, again, what kind of thinking are we trying to do here? Now, you could hire, well, maybe you have hired already, you know, the sort of director of health for McKinsey or somebody like that, you know, and they could possibly come up to Glasgow and give you, you know, solutions, you know, already packaged and, you know, with a price tag on it and so on. What we're doing here is probably more about debates. However, we have to be aware that, yeah, there's a real world out there. People have limited amounts of funding, time, and so on. So there is a need to, again, think across the centre of the room. And this is a continuous challenge for myself. Well, this is the process, the four-stage thing, which I mentioned. And again, we'll come to this in the question times. But it's very simple in concepts, really, is to say, OK, first you map the landscape. Where are we? How do things work? What's the issues? What's the system that we're working in? This may not be immediately apparent, particularly in something which is incredibly joined up, like public health. Now, I'll say also one other important thing. I am not a health professional. I'm a sustainable cities professional, and I was an architect. So I appreciate some of the, you know, issues that public health people do. And actually, I did spend quite a long time working with the healthy cities people in the Northwest. And we know that public health is a very joined up sort of thing. It doesn't work just, you know, on its own. It's got to have collaborations with all these different other institutions, professions, sectors, and so on. So how do we keep track of that? Well, we need some way of mapping the landscape that we work in. And we know also that this landscape is changing. It doesn't stay still for very long. And we know that the future is probably going to be not like today. And it's also, we know that we can't know. There are uncertainties everywhere. So to, again, map out the field of uncertainties and possibilities, well, we need a scenario approach. We need divergent thinking. We say, what if this happened? What if that happened? What if it rains tomorrow? Well, maybe I should take an umbrella. What if it's not raining tomorrow? Well, maybe I'll do something else, and so on. The heart of the thing is then round to the third stage. The synergy stage is where somehow or other, there's no blueprint on how to do it, but somehow or other, we need to create a space where people can have good ideas. And not only good ideas on their own, in isolation, you know, in a darkened room, well, maybe, but more likely to be good ideas in collaboration with others. So collective good ideas. This then is really the idea of synergy. And then, of course, once we've had some good ideas, well, we need to come back to, you know, the real world, so-called, put them into practice. So we have a strategy phase, policies, projects, roadmaps, get real, find the funding, and so on. So that's roughly how it works, and that's how the technology fits in, which I've just covered. So I'll leave that there, and that's the background which I mentioned. I should say also, I'm working in Europe quite a lot, and at the moment working with the United Nations Habitat, the cities branch of the United Nations in Nairobi. So things are quite interesting at the moment. So, well, coming on to the landscape mapping, any comments or interjections so far? Okay, I'll take silence as a yes. Well, I won't dwell on all this stuff because I'm sure you're familiar with it and I'm sure you know much more than I do. But something, you know, just to sort of put it on the table, the King's Fund reports on trends in healthcare and so on, and some quite, you know, shocking things that you knew already, but actually, you know, only a quarter of patients can actually see the doctor that they want to see. Everybody else is sort of, you know, shunted around. Only just 10% have some kind of care plan. Now, this is astounding. In Scandinavia, it's something like 75%, as far as I'm aware. And three-quarters of people with depression and anxiety receive no treatment at all. Have to go down to the chemist and get some pills. It's just, astonishing. What does the King's Fund say should be done? These are kind of tried and tested recommendations. And to be absolutely honest, the list looks very similar to what it did 10 years ago or maybe more, to my, non-expert eye. In other words, 10 years ago or even maybe 20 years ago when I started all this stuff, we said, yes, patients and service users should be part of the team. Of course, right, what a good idea. We should use technology to revolutionise experience. Great, yes, let's do it. We should harness new technologies more effectively. Great. Intelligent use of data, and so on and so on. And I'm sure you're very familiar with all this. And the big question is, are we getting anywhere? Are we making progress, or are the other forces too great, or what? So, and then, of course, there are wider and more global trends. And this is just a very short list. And on the right-hand side, more global issues, climate change, for instance, the demographics of emerging countries, climate change leading to food and water, and food and water shortages leading to urbanisation, migration, displacement, fragmentation, alienation, and so on and so on. And my personal guess is, unless we, seriously get our act together, many people in the world, a decade or two or three from now, will be having a pretty rough time. Now, I'm not here to talk about cities as such, but we do know that current trends are very powerful. Two-thirds of all the urban city dwellers of the future are likely to be living in slum and squatted settlements. And that, again, is kind of astounding. Anyway, those are the wider trends. And then, my own experience, I have a friend who's a GP, and she is really, really frustrated. If there's any doctors here, they might kind of share that kind of view. A public health officer. She should be doing public health, but she's spending her whole time, re-tendering for her team to do the work which they were already been doing, and so on. And then you have the patient perspective. And again, well, this is just reading off, my doctor's kind of, list. And one of the things that we discover amongst many challenges is, there's a certain resistance among patients, clients, users, and so on. And I'm sure, again, you'll be very familiar with these things. Health services, great material for cartooning. These are not mine, but, you get the general idea. Now, of course, I have to say, in England, we are, sailing off the edge of a cliff in terms of our NHS. So we have to come to Scotland to find out, how it's supposed to be done. At the moment, we're in a state of, complete disarray and disillusionment. It's really distressing. But of course, even in Scotland, I imagine things aren't quite, perfect, and the challenges possibly will be mounting up. Well, here's some cartoons which didn't quite get worded. The one on the left was basically a picture where everybody in the city is just sort of doing their job, The housing officers are just doing their job, and the retail supermarket operators, they're just doing their job, and the people in running the pub who have sold this man rather too much drink, so he's now horizontal, they're just doing their job, and so on and so on. So, of course, if everyone just does their job, if the jobs are configured in a way which then builds up patterns and has huge gaps in between them, well, of course, that's the result. We have a situation. When I started doing this, I looked back at WHO, and actually, many years ago, they were talking about health fields, my team sort of looked at these and started tracing the causal links, and even if we could find some numbers, well, then we fed the numbers in, and so on and so on. So we're basically trying to sort of piece together the idea of a metabolism. Now, the metabolism means stuff comes through it, energy is released, value is generated. You have things sort of upstream, and you have other things which are sort of downstream. So this is only part of a larger metabolism in public health. But this is kind of, you know, a place to start, because what you could immediately start to observe is, although, you know, we've just got these big triangles, in fact, almost every one of these boxes is kind of interconnected in some way or other. And often those interconnections are not quite sort of tangible to say, well, you know, from culture to, you know, security to, you know, mental health and so on and so on. These things are complex. You need, you know, thousands of researchers to sort of, you know, look for correlations and so on. But we know that, yeah, the not only that, that there are different levels. We can talk about a personal or pathway level, unit or organisation level, policy and society level, and so on. Each of those levels then intersects. So already we can really envisage quite a complex kind of set of causes, effects and relationships or interactions. So this kind of opens the door onto what we work with and we call a relational system. And a relational system is actually really simple in concept. You need a big table and a load of chairs around it, and then everybody who sits around the table is playing some kind of role. They have some kind of job, some kind of role to play. And if we say, well, actually, this one's more of an economic picture. But, you know, there's about 12 different seats around the table, and we can look for the connection between any one of these and any other one of these. And actually, Tony Hodgson, who's sitting at the front, has kind of followed this to the right to the logical conclusion, and worked out that, in fact, there are 66 connections in the world game, which some of you might have participated in. If you have 12 people around the table. What if you have 15 people who all want to sit around the table? Well, then you probably need two tables. Our sort of experience and rule of thumb is if you have more than 12 people, well, usually some people are just not going to say very much. So more than 12, well, then, you know, two tables and so on. And what we can then sort of observe roughly is that, yes, we have this metabolism of idea. There are things upstream, there are system inputs, there are interventions by policy or other things. You have drivers of change. And then downstream you have outputs and outcomes. If anyone deals in public policy, you'll be aware of the fine-tuned difference between an output and an outcome, and so on. And also impacts and so on and so on. And if the impacts aren't right, or if they're doing somebody else some damage, well, then you should have a feedback loop to adjust things. And, of course, this is all, you know, nice textbook theory. What the most of the textbooks don't have in their pictures is this idea of a relational community. In other words, and, you know, policy design, policy science and so on, basically said, well, you know, you have your objective, your inputs, outputs, outcomes, and it's all in a kind of logical framework, as so-called. And you say, well, wait a minute, you know, what if things are really quite fuzzy and complex and you're not sure if it's going to work and so on? And, well, you know, then that's all in the art of it. You know, the science doesn't seem to quite get that far. I'm generalising. But you get the general thing. Of course, the other thing is, although the picture shows these blobs as all the same size and all very nice and democratic, well, actually, of course, stakeholders are never equal. Some have old money, some have more power, some have more knowledge, some just have, you know, they're bigger, and so on. So this is all then part of the picture. So then we can say, well, what if, you know, we're not just talking about an economic system, we're talking about a social system or even a cultural system where people have values at the back of their minds and their spirits and so on. which then guide the things that they do in everyday life. So, and also there may be a technical system if we're dealing with a technology, like, you know, water supply, for instance. And that technology may have ecological effects which are not in our, you know, immediate human boundary, and so on and so on. So, well, again, we're just learners in all this, but we've been doing futures and foresight techniques for quite a while. There's a thing called STEEP. Anyone familiar with STEEP, or STEEP-V as it is then translated to? Well, it just means social, technological, economic, ecological, political, and then you can have values. They've flipped up to the top here. You can add on a few more of your favourite themes. And it just means, somehow or other, we need a way to sort of keep track of, you know, this kind of joined-up thinking. So we say, yes, we're talking about social technology, all the way down the list. And, of course, we're not just talking about these things one by one. We then have to keep track of all the interactions. And that's, you know, where it gets fascinating. We can also approach a thing by asking questions like who, why, what, and so on. And to put the whole thing together, well, we can visualise it as a 3D, you know, stack of plates, or if the connections seem more important, then we can talk. Put it into a cloud and so on. Now, this is all just sort of playing with, you know, how to draw a map of a complex multi-level reality. In a moment, we should talk about what to do with the map. But just to finish on this one, and, well, the interesting thing is, if we talk about cities as a whole, and this diagram is more about cities than it is about health per se, we can observe that there's a lot of stuff going on in cities that seems to be quite complex. And if you read textbooks on, you know, urban development, then they tend to assume that, you know, nothing really matters much except the economy and investment and where the houses are in relation to the workplace and so on. But if you look at other things, like social and cultural issues, well, you say, yes, that sort of intersects with the economy in quite an interesting and complicated way. And then you look at the governance. How does politics work? How do public services work? And, of course, then we know that cities are responsible, and this would be another lecture for another time, but I could go on at length about how cities dump their waste and their pollution and their climate emissions and so on, using, you know, the local and global environment as a dumping ground. And we can say, yeah, this whole thing combined has certain kind of system-wide behaviour. One is dumping, and another is, up at the top, extraction and expropriation. And what do we mean by that? Well, of course, that is pretty easy to see with the global financial system. At the moment, a colleague did a study. 90% of Manchester's pensions go back to the City of London, where pensions are, you know, traded on the marketplace and so on. But only a small fraction of that huge fund comes back to Manchester in the way of investment. So, you know, in crude terms, the global financial markets are sucking capital out of Manchester and using it for their own purposes. And meanwhile, Manchester, well, I don't know if you know Manchester, but, you know, the centre's quite glitzy now, but, you know, large areas are just kind of, you know, going nowhere fast. So that's the extraction and expropriation. So we can also say, well, what is this sustainability thing in this light of, you know, kind of more joined up thinking? And, I mean, this diagram looks, you know, quite sort of simplistic, really. It took 15 years of hard efforts and thinking, you know, to get to this point. But we could say, oh, right, so of course, if we're talking about one kind of sustainability, well, that's great. If we have, you know, an ecological sustainability, well, what does that do for the economy? What does that do for social and public services? What does that do for fixed capital in housing and so on? And can it work alongside, you know, the need of financial capital to recirculate and so on? So we could say, roughly, as a generalisation, sustainable development equals different systems working together in synergy. Wow. Yeah, so, you know, that's Nobel Prize worth, you know, already. Then we can start to look for examples and say, well, yes, gosh, things that have really worked in my city are where we can see, you know, social cohesion, public health, plus inward investment, plus strong governance, plus ecological improvement. It all starts to stack up together. And these things are not just like items on a menu. Each one is kind of, you know, a live thing that needs to find a way to interact and connect with the other things. So it needs creative thinking. Well, that's conclusion number one. Now, if we then say, OK, so how's this going to work for well health? Just to explain the word well health, it just came up about 24 hours ago when I was doing this briefing paper, and I thought, well, what is this thing called? Is it health and well-being? That kind of implies that health and well-being are, you know, two separate and side-by-side things. So I thought, well, you know, what if you had well-health being or well-being, you know, some phrase anyway. So well-health, if said rapidly in a fuzzy sort of way, you know, late in a bar or something, you might think it's, oh, it's wealth. I did some work with the Sustainable Development Commission in London on wealth and prosperity and what to do about wealth if there is no economic growth, which is obviously now the case. The short answer is, yes, of course, we need to, you know, increase the and empower people to improve their social and cultural and ecological assets so that even if they haven't got a bean, they'll still have a great life. You know, I mean, again, profound thinking, but, you know, with many sort of more detailed applications. Well, coming back to health, we can see different levels, but we also see that things aren't in a straight line. There's a community surrounding every patient or client or user. There's a community of professionals. There's a community of policy people at other levels, and so on. So how do they all interact and interconnect? And I'll be guided by you on this. Possibly, you know, we can learn from you people at least as much as the other way. Again, as I regard Scotland as a, you know, place of, you know, wonderful intellectual endeavour and so on. How do they do this? Well, how does my doctor, for instance, if I go to him and say, well, look, I really can't sleep at night. This is my one health problem, actually. And, you know, it's not because I'm anxious, not because I'm depressed. I just have too many ideas. Yeah. So she will say, well, but all the time the clock is ticking. And, you know, she's, you know, as soon as she's understood my condition, well, you know, you're kind of running out of minutes and so on. So she said, well, you know, you could try these, you know, try going for walks, and so on and so on. In other words, in a very short space of time, she needs to learn about my life and my condition and my sort of, you know, metabolism and so on and so on. Now, of course, that's just a little one-off within a 10-minute slot. But if you look at how people work out there in all kinds of walks of life, well, they are learning and adapting continuously. In my work as an architect 25 years ago, we had to learn about the community. We had to then design. We then test it with the community. We learn what their responses are. We adapt and so on and so on. And of course, well, this is where community architecture is not far from public health, because we're not just providing a technical solution to a technical problem, or in the architectural world, you know, a technical solution that looks really glossy, you know, in some magazine. For my own part, I was dedicated to finding, you know, holistic solutions to people's real living environments, which are multi-layer, full of problems, full of opportunities. Anyway, so that's the basic take on public health. Now, if we were in the business of drawing, you know, larger scale landscapes, we could then start putting these different parts of the picture together and tracing lines between one and the next and so on. I think we'll move on from there and maybe come back to it if we need it, because this is where it gets kind of almost too abstract. If we say, OK, what if we look at a healthy city agenda? Now, I have to apologise, this is 12 years old and it was originally done in quite a different format, so I've just adapted it a bit to fit, you know, the way that we do things now. But you get the general idea, which was to say, if we convened a workshop on scenario thinking at the time, 12 years ago, in Manchester, and John Ashton was there, some of you might remember him, Director of Public Health for the North West Region. And so first of all, we had to really kind of, you know, be really honest about, you know, what do people think about, you know, public services? How are they working? You know, let's look at the kind of downside because we are aware that things weren't working. You know, Manchester's got terrible health inequalities, terrible substance abuse, you know, all kinds of problems, which it shares with Glasgow, actually. So why wasn't it working? So everybody said, well, yeah, the media, they're not helping. They just want a good story, you know. And the research labs at the university, well, they don't seem to help much either because they chase money and prestige, and so on and so on. Now, you know, this kind of thing can be useful as a way of kind of opening up an agenda. It's not, it's the beginning of a discussion and certainly not the end of a discussion, because, you know, you wouldn't sort of take this as a negative description of a discussion and then say, oh, right, that's that then. But you get the general idea. And then, of course, if you have the time, then you can start charting in more detail the interconnections. I have a feeling that these might have got scrambled in translation. So they may not be the literal interpretation, but we'll come back to that. So, this is where it kind of... there's a sort of break point. If we took these questions and spread them around the room, now, what we don't have time or space for is, you know, to start a whole half-day workshop and, you know, get a whole load of round tables and everybody has their say around the table and we do flip charts or we do, you know, technology or whatever. So I just wanted, if possible, to give you some kind of brief taster for what could be a longer thing. So if I could switch over to here, and aware of clocks ticking and that kind of thing, maybe we only have one of these question and answer things. But what we were basically doing in many previous versions of this kind of thing is basically saying, who do you work with? And do you get on with them or do you not get on with them? Can you summarise in about three or four words the attitudes that you have to the people who you most work with on an average day? So maybe if I could just start with the public health people if I can ask some representative of the public health community, who do you most work with on an average day? Any representatives of public health here? Yes. Okay, great. And another one. Another one, sorry. Who else do you most work with? Well, anybody. Say that again.
Private care, GPs.
Okay. So with doctors? Okay. Sorry, my hearing isn't actually perfect. So now we should be able to see, very roughly, a couple of links starting to be made. Is there any NHS managers here? Who would, I think somebody put their hand up. maybe I shouldn't ask that question in public. On an average day, who would you spend most time with out of these different people? Is it possible to pin it down? Doctors, possibly?
Doctors, other managers.
Okay. okay. Well, probably we can leave it there and maybe come back to it in the scenarios bit. But you get the general idea that, we are systematically trying to find a way, the most effective way, to track the relationships between different groups of people. And why are we doing this? Well, we think it's probably a good way to systematically look for collaborations and shared thinking and so on, if we can systematically track who is working with who. Now, of course, there are other ways, there are other views on this. There's, organisation structure charts and there's, workflow charts and all this kind of thing. So this is not the only way. However, we think this is possibly going to be useful if we're dealing with things that are beyond the organisation or beyond the immediate sort of job specifications and so on. So we'll come back to that. any sort of general comments so far? Is this making any sense whatsoever? Let's look at the future. It's always my favourite topic because it's difficult to be wrong about the future for a start. Plus, I get the chance to draw lots of little funny people, which is my favourite thing. We use scenario work because the future is very uncertain. We don't know if it's going to rain or snow or shine tomorrow. So we have to say, maybe this, maybe that, maybe the other. How should we plan accordingly, given that these things have different risk ratings and different impact factors and so on and so on? So, of course, if you're looking at the future of a whole country, 20, 30 years into the future, which is the lifetime of major decisions and major infrastructures and major investments and so on, you need a fairly well worked out way of doing it. Previously, I helped on the Scottish Ecological Footprint Project, and that had a futures scenarios chapter to it. So, this kind of summarises some of it. You look for what could go right, what you want to achieve, what could go wrong. You look for wild cards, high impact, low probability things. And you look for Murphy's Laws, that what can go wrong will go wrong, possibly, and so on and so on. So what happens if we start to use this approach in public health? The things on the left-hand side are fairly well known and talked about by, the King's Fund and various other kind of bodies. And maybe the Centre for Population Health also has done this kind of thing. So the things on the right are things that we've been more concerned with at the moment, which is to say, let's look beyond the immediate sort of trends and, forces that we have to deal with, but let's look at the fundamentals. One fundamental seems to be between the sort of linear model of healthcare, where patient, condition, medicine, treatment, out the other side, and a more relational or holistic model of healthcare, which we've seen in the recommendations, and health inequalities. This kind of runs right through the middle of the whole thing. But again, is this just inequality that might be measured on some kind of scale? Or is it more like actually living in a separate society, parallel world and so on? So to explore these things, we can use scenarios. Now, I'm borrowing some scenarios that I worked on. They're actually from the USA, but they translate reasonably well. And you can look up if you want to, Vulnerability 2030. And the basic ideas were, yeah, American culture and, you know, and the rhetoric of economic growth, etc. It's all about, you know, being big and strong and out there and competitive and so on. But we know from experience that, you know, large sections of the population are not big and strong and out there. They are vulnerable, they are insecure, they are anxious and so on, including, you know, people around families. So let's look at the vulnerability of such people and then through exploring it through different scenarios, think about how to respond, not just today and tomorrow, but, you know, in a slightly longer term. So, well, here's one, and luckily, you know, the coalition Tories get back in and the economy rebounds and everything's great, but actually, you know, the UK as a whole is kind of sold off, you know, and all the jobs go to China and India, and the government still has no money, and so on and so on. So the ranks of the vulnerable still are growing. And then, so of course, this has profound implications for well-being and health. If we look for an opposite scenario, well, the double dip or triple dip recession, then oil prices go up rapidly, energy, food prices rise rapidly, nobody seems to have any jobs anymore, and so on. And all government services are slashed, you know, to the point of non-existence. And there are some elements in the UK political landscape who think, you know, this is probably, you know, where they want to go. And again, you know, obviously big implications for well-being and health. And so then we say, okay, these are things, you know, little vignettes about the future, but we can see the seeds of the future in the present. So if we can, well, we'll certainly see this one. And then the next one. A Great Depression followed the Great Recession, etc., etc. You know, this is all fairly kind of dark, but, you know, continuing sort of, you know, known economic trends at this moment. But luckily, everyone sort of pulled around. Governments were forced to be more effective and democratic. People were forced to be more community-minded and mutual aid and so on and so on. Now, of course, as soon as any community gets together and say, yes, we're doing mutual aid, there will always be some people who are excluded. And again, because resources are very scarce, healthcare is very precious, the line around what is socially acceptable to do in your life is again changed. So there we see, you know, the happy community in their streets and so on. We don't see the people sort of, you know, living in cardboard boxes and so on. And, well, scenario four is when things more or less come right, not possibly for the most obvious of reasons, but households become more self-reliant and entrepreneurial. They use a lot of IT, which is, you know, into its sort of sixth or seventh generation by this time, you know, which helps local bartering services and mutual aid and supports innovation of all kinds. Vulnerability generally reduces. And people are more aware than ever of the risks of their lifestyles and their activities and so on and so on. So anyway, to leave it there, these are just four snapshots of public health agendas and issues and challenges in the near future. Again, on the basis that the seeds of the future are already here in the present, if we just know how to look for them. Sorry, this got a bit fuzzy. It's also very useful to do horizon scanning, meaning to systematically look at trends and signals of impending changes. And it's also very useful to look for wild cards. This is just one, the health page from our wild card project of that website. There's actually, you know, quite a lot of health examples. And some of them then got explored on flip charts in workshops, and so of course these are wild ideas to say what if, but again, you know, the seeds of the what if questions are usually contained in things that are all around us. And one on the right-hand side, you know, every toilet in every house will be fitted with some intelligent robotic sensing machine, which feeds back, and it's even got a little avatar, you know, who talks to you, who then starts to read your eye movements and so on. And so, of course, the user, the common garden user, will be desperate to turn the ghastly thing off, but that's not allowed, and so on. Anyway, that's one little example. So, again, well, questions. Changes in one's workplace. Well, again, if we had, you know, a good sort of half day, really minimum, we could sort of get into some very interesting stuff here. But if we could just take a few random thoughts. Who is experiencing massive disruptive change in their workplace right now? Or they can see it coming. Any offers on that? Yes, please. They're losing jobs. Yeah, okay. I can relate to that myself. So what we would say that's kind of other public sector for, you know, shorthand, losing jobs and funding, presumably. That's, I imagine, that is kind of setting you back in terms of what you want to achieve. So maybe you have to then think of other ways of doing it, which weren't in the original script, and so on. Any other offers on rapid disruptive changes right now? What about technology and medicine and so on? Yes, please.
The welfare reforms are increasingly inequalities.
So, can you speak up?
The welfare reforms are increasingly inequalities.
Right, yes. And that does apply to Scotland in some measure. So where would we fit that into our roughly, well, we'll say that's a user issue. So okay. Now, if we had more time, we would then start trying to track the causes and effects and relationships. Sorry, you can only see it very faintly here. And I say, okay, so who's involved in this inequality? You know, what do they think? And do they see the same trend? And if so, you know, is it inequality all over or is it concentrated in some groups? And so on and so on and so on. In other words, you know, this is just the start of what could be a very long discussion. But again, we find from experience, if the discussion can be had on the basis of collaborations and relationships, rather than just people saying, well, you know, I'm a doctor and things are getting really, really bad, you know, and somebody else says, well, I'm a local government person and things are even worse. Yeah, that's good to know. But what we're really interested in is how this then changes the system that we're all working in. Anyway, so I'll leave that one there, and maybe if there's time in the general discussion at the end, come back. And thanks for your contributions. So, well, if we then come on to say, well, we've mapped the landscape, we've looked at the future, now what? Well, we need some really good creative ideas. How are these ideas going to work? Well, first of all, I can just show you one example from my previous hometown. It's called Incredible Edible. Some of you might have heard of it because they're very good on the PR and all that kind of thing. And what we find is, and here's a sort of cartoon version of the town, what we find is everyone seems to be working with everybody else, much more than they ever did before. So the farmers are working with the schools, the NGOs are working with the marketplace, the local politicians are working with landowners, the tourist operators are working with anyone, and so on and so on. The agenda on the surface is about growing food. And they're very proud of themselves to say, yes, they have discovered the universal language of sustainability, and it's called food. So, great. I'm still, you know, not quite 100% convinced, but I think it's wonderful. And they do little innovations such as this thing you can't quite see, but this is a using Google Maps to show you where all the eggs are being produced in the local area. And you say, well, why would you want to do that? Well, because if you're serious about local food, healthy, organic, etc., etc., you need to know where your nearest supplier is, and you need to know also if they've run out, so you go to somebody else before you, you know, walk all the way up the track. So you've got an egg map, which is continuously real-time updated. Now, that's just one tiny little example. But you say, well, that's interesting. What would happen if you were a, you know, asthma sufferer? Could you plot yourself on Google Maps? And I say, well, you know, it was bad on Tuesday, but not so bad now. And then other people would come along and say, well, yeah, there was a, you know, severe sort of depression, you know, meteorological thing on Monday, and so on and so on. In other words, you start to build up the collective intelligence using, in that case, you know, a tiny bit of social technology. But the bigger scheme, the bigger picture really is to say, well, if everyone works with everyone else, then wonderful things can happen. And this is kind of obvious, but, you know, we've still got to sort of reinvent it. Now, of course, nothing is ever quite so simple. Within this idealised utopian vision, yes, you know, there is a hierarchy, there are personality problems, there are feuds and splits, some people feel excluded from the central committee, and all this kind of stuff. So this is, you know, inevitable. We think IT can actually be a powerful medium to get past that. And what we're basically doing, and this is the 3.0 bit, and this is also in the handout, what we are basically doing is taking a town which was on its knees only 20, 30 years ago. First it began to adapt because it simply could not fight, you know, the disinvestment and the economic restructuring and the depopulation and the local pollution and so on and so on. So it was still in a linear mode of thinking where people say, well, how are we going to clean up this river? Oh my God, it's really hard and it's really expensive and we have no money. And that, in a sense, is a kind of linear response. So then we managed somehow to make a transition into some kind of adaptive response, partly through circumstance. New people kind of moved in and they were of a different mindset and so on, but also through a kind of shift in the way that we could envisage the future. So we said, let's not worry today about cleaning up the river. Let's get new industries in for whom they do a different kind of thing in life and they have different kind of clients. For them, a clean river is really important. It's part of their brand image. So once the industries are there, then of course, you know, they'll say, yeah, we'll clean up the river, no problem, you know. So that was a kind of adaptive response. Now, that's great as far as it goes, but then we say, okay, well, you know, in the adaptive response world, and this is 2.0 in the scheme of things, that's great for the winners, so-called, but we still have a lot of losers, so-called. And the metaphor of a biological system is quite apt because you should say, well, if you let the garden run wild, well, of course, you know, you'll have nettles and brambles 6 feet high, you know, if you don't do anything about it. And that's a kind of image of a an adaptive system. There's a lot of theory behind this coming from ecology and organisation studies and all sorts of things. So we then say, OK, what if we could think about what we're doing before it happened? What if we could use all of our human qualities of thinking, learning, questioning, creative energy, strategy, self-awareness even, shared intelligence, personal development, etc., to then really kind of transform this place? And in a sense, that's the aspiration of this this little town up there in the hills. Now, they don't sort of talk about, you know, great long words. They're actually more interested in doing it than they are in theory. One of their problems is, you know, they're now so famous, they have researchers banging on their door all the time. It's a real problem. But the main thing is, yeah, they have seen intuitively what they are trying to do, which is say, yes, of course, all of these different people should talk to each other, work together, dream together, and so on. And there may be an intuitive way of doing that. There may be a sort of more interventionist way of doing that, of helping that to happen. So this is really what we're about. Now, of course, we can then track over to the right-hand side and say, yeah, what does this mean for public health? Well, this is really what we're here to discuss. And then there's a bit more sort of theory. I think I will skip over that. Thank you. And then we say, okay, how does this, you know, can we visualise this? And the first thing is to look at how public services are organised. And when we say governance, well, actually large corporations, you know, have governance, which is equally elaborate and often inefficient and so on. So it's not just about the public sector and, you know, democratic local government and so on. It's about running any kind of organisation. So we say, yes, you know, old style model. We had command and control. The chief executive would sit in, you know, white, middle-aged male CEO would sit in his office, you know, giving orders and so on, and have section heads and all the rest of it. And if we talk about democracy, well, the public would just be out there and they get to vote once every 5 or 4 years, a very inefficient way of providing feedback and so on. So what we're trying to do is make a transition over to this kind of self-organising governance where the providers or people sort of in a structural position, making policy and so on, are more kind of joined up than they would be. And the public, they can also self-organise. They're not just sort of passive objects. They get themselves together. And of course, in order to do that, we need a better form of knowledge sharing, intelligence sharing, learning and so on and so on. So that's a kind of picture of a governance situation. Now, the Well Health or Wellbeing 3.0, this is just one of a set of 3.0 themes. Again, these are not sort of fixed in stone. They're all, you know, quite fluid. But each of these themes, and I've titled it urban because that's my own, you know, speciality, has a similar sort of effect to it, which is to say, yeah, we're looking for something which self-organises, shares its intelligence, it grows and evolves. It's not just, you know, a fix to a technical problem. So, well, then we can go further into mapping of different systems in this way and looking, you know, for different kind of network effects. What's very interesting, I mean, this just tracking over to social technology for a moment, because this is, you know, changing so fast, and it's absolutely fascinating. We can look for different models of how things organise themselves. Some of them are vastly clever, but still basically, you know, a hierarchical model. Others are extremely sort of networked, like Facebook here in this example, or Google to some extent, but they haven't yet worked out how to do anything more than, you know, saying, well, do you like, you know, the latest whatever, or, you know, can you search for, you know, healthy cities and get 10 zillion hits and so on. So, again, we're just on the cusp of this thing. Well, and so then, well, our characters then come back and, again, they take some persuading and convincing, you know. So this shared intelligence, great, but, you know, intelligence is not equally shared, let's be honest. There's still winners or losers, and so on. So, you know, it's a continuous process at work here. Well, we'll skip over the questions. Seriously behind schedule now. Apologies in advance. And then, okay, well, we get to the final stage around the circle. This is actually an example from Mauritius. I've been working in Mauritius on their science and technology program and putting some of these ideas into practice. And what was interesting here is that... wrong page. The page I should have put up had public health as... at the top of this table. And this is interesting because Mauritius, you might know, is an emerging nation. It's doing very well. It's one of the best in Africa, if you count it as in Africa. So suddenly, within a space of a decade, suddenly they've got obesity, they've got diabetes, they've got attention disorder, they've got suddenly all these syndromes that we've sort of got used to now as being part of the landscape, suddenly they're all there. So you say, oh my God, you know, what do we do? Do we change the diet? Do we, you know, rebuild the housing? Do we turn off the all these TV channels that are, you know, promoting all this junk food? And so on. And, you know, it's a really big and urgent problem. So we've tried to use the thing, if I found the right page, as a way of discovering this thing and then coming round to saying, OK, so what are we going to do? Now, at that point, we have to use some imagination, because without imagination, it's really not going to work. And if we use the circles image, well, we can say, yes, we are looking for where the circles intersect. And where the circles intersect is usually a boundary zone or multifunctional zone. So if we took one example, if we took the ecological system and we took the social and cultural system, and we say, yeah, well, let's have some ecological projects which are also, you know, good for people's heritage and culture and leisure and that kind of thing. And then the question is, can we link it to any kind of economic or financial activity in order to get some money coming through? So that's the kind of very simple train of thought. If we follow that kind of train of thought all the way through to the end, we end up with the example of the little town, which I showed, where everybody seems to be talking to everybody else. And great things are happening. So we can sort of generalise and stand back and say, OK, synergistics, long word, but it means really the process of interconnecting between different systems, thinking multifunctionality, and thinking about, you know, each side as a learning process, and so on. So, well, then we can then translate it back to our, you know, public health round table. And so, yeah, each one of these people around the table, and I think most of them are in the room, has some kind of role to play. Now, because this, again, came from a 10-year-old project, I wasn't able to translate all the sort of relationships and linkages, but that could then be the next step, which is to say, OK, so health education, yes, how's that going to work, you know, in a joined-up way, not just, you know, a linear way. One example, actually, just came up in this workshop. The health education unit at the time, again, 10 years ago, maybe it's better now, but the health education unit had targets, you know, to justify their funding, which was always on a shoestring. So they said, oh, what are their targets? Well, we had to produce, you know, 100,000 leaflets. So they said, OK, well, you know, did you hand out the leaflets? They said, well, we tried to, but actually our target was just to produce these leaflets. So if we sort of inquired a bit more closely, we said, well, actually, there's a lot of leaflets still under the desk, you know, in boxes. So, oh, you know, that's one tiny example of how a kind of linear mode of thinking, which is kind of enshrined and fixed in stone in so many policies and funding processes, then kind of really gets in the way of doing a really good job. Anyway, so if we then say, well, the issue here is about design of organisations, design of policies, design of workflows and so on. And not only that, we have to design these things like professional mandates. You know, whose job is it to change a swab on some patient here, you know? And, well, these things happen all the time, all the way through the service. But if we are looking for joined up ways of working that address these larger problems, well, actually we have to address simple questions as well. But we can also say, this is not entirely new. In fact, you know, it's quite, you know, it's happening all around, with new stuff, with old stuff. I find it fascinating where patients can now self-organise and start blogs and start communicating with themselves, and they may even question the judgment of a doctor. Actually, my sister is an ME sufferer for 20 years and more. And the doctors are sort of, you know, send here, send there, nobody can really explain it, and so on, and say, well, here's some pills, you know, tried all holistic things, round the houses, So she has a community, you know, of like-minded sufferers. They self-organise, they promote, they campaign, they've started to locate themselves on a map, and so on and so on. And talking about substance abuse, well, in a good neighbourhood, local shopkeepers will be there on the street corner. They can keep an eye out for the youths around the corner that they know. So it's not going to solve the problem, but it probably is going to help quite a lot. And you contrast that with another kind of neighbourhood where there are no shopkeepers. They've all been erased, you know, and so on. So, again, synergistic design is not only about what's inside the boundary, it's also about things that are on the other side of the boundary, in other, you know, public services, private enterprise, and so on and so on. So take that example. How would we persuade local shopkeepers? Well, first of all, how do we persuade local shopkeepers to stay open when there's a Tesco's down the road sucking out all of their trade? Well, maybe there's ways to do that, you know, through community-owned shops and voluntary things and so on and so forth. Secondly, how do we persuade the shopkeepers to actually make a tiny bit of time to keep an eye open for the local youths who might be in, you know, a bad state of mind or whatever? Well, that's not easy to write into a job description. It's something that has to be sort of built up over, you know, as part of a web of relationships in the community. Now, some areas just do this without even thinking. Other areas are like deserts and, you know, concrete jungles. And then, yeah, big surprise, the local youths take substances and get drunk and all the rest of it. We see this in Manchester very clearly. Well, talking about organisational design, this is the fascinating diagram of the NHS in England. And this one, I think, is Scotland. Is this Scotland? Can anyone advise that? I couldn't quite track it down. Maybe not. Okay, let's skip hastily over that. Sorry. and then, okay, so, you know, what do organisations look like? What will the public health service look like? What will doctors look like, you know, in the future? Will we still have, you know, a medical profession with huge, you know, entry requirements and so on? Well, there may be some interesting directions. We can't say at this moment, you know, there's no blueprints that I can see in front of me. But if we're designing professions with the remit to follow the humans rather than follow their job specifications, well, we might be designing organisations which are more like networks, less like, you know, boxes, and so on. Rhizomatic in this sense means, you know, decentralised, you know, self-organising. If we can design financial values that follow social and ecological values, well, that sounds like a good idea. How on earth would we do that? Again, looking from examples like the little town in the hills, where suddenly there seems to be a lot of local food being produced. And it's actually being given away for free because people seem to enjoy producing it and they enjoy giving it away for free more than they enjoy selling it. Now, you know, again, you have to sort of just be careful, not take everything at face value. But you can observe a process in progress, which is to say, yeah, if people enjoy doing something, then that's got a social value. They might not be so bothered about the financial value. So let's design things which enable people to enjoy themselves. Well, what could be better than that? And we'll skip over this bit, and these are the sorts of questions which would come up in a workshop setting. So again, that's for later. What next? Well, I'm going to stop. No slides. So thank you very much. Sorry I've overrun. Thanks for contributions. Let's get some questions and debate.